the Spirit of Jazz podcast, where music dances with mystery, with your hosts, Bill Carter and Jeff Kellum.
Hey, welcome to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is Bill Carter.
And I'm your lovely and talented co-host, Jeff Kellum.
He's the best-looking co-host on podcast or radio.
Man, you are just so kind. And you'll have to go to confession now. We're standing on the verge of the release of Bill's book from Broadleaf Books, Thriving on a Riff, Jazz and the Spiritual Life. We've referenced this a couple of times previously, but let's talk about, you've written some other books, but this book is special. It's special because it's about your two loves, the spiritual life and jazz. Is it easier to write a book than it is to write a composition?
Oh, that's a good question. It's an extended composition, for one thing. I've done a number of sermon collections for CSS publications out of Ohio, and most of them were just helping them out develop resources for pastors who are looking for good sermons. I thought, well, I don't do good sermons, but I'll give you the best ones I can put together. And so here they are. And they would come out, you know, a year later or so, and that would be that.
Yeah.
Done a couple other collections for my denomination. We put together a jazz hymnal, Swinging a New Song to the Lord, which I edited back in, I think, 2003 or four.
Wow, 20 years ago.
That's right. But this has been perking long enough that I thought this is kind of a life project. This is many ways. You talked about my two loves. This is actually one love with two threads that are woven intricately together. And that's something I had to back into and understand, because I always thought jazz was something on the side. Or when I would be playing, jazz was the thing of the moment. Mm-hmm. But to perceive that, you know, as we do with this podcast and the great people we talk to, that there's something spiritual afoot in the making and the hearing of this music. So, you know, to write about that has been a challenge, because nobody writes easily about music. They can write about musicians. If they write about music, they use euphemisms or discuss, you know, the people making it, but they or the context, but they don't say a whole lot that the general reader will want to hear. Mm-hmm. So I had to be very careful. And at various points, some of the guiding voices kept pushing me. They asked the question, who are you writing for? Who's your audience?
Sure. Yeah. It's like who are you preaching to, or who are you playing music for? That's right. Important to know the audience.
And I'd say, I'm writing for everybody. They'd say, no, you're not. First of all, you're writing for everybody who wants to read your book. I said, okay, I'm writing for the people who want to read my book. And they said, well, and who would those be? We'll help you figure out how to reach them, but you need to do that harder work of focus. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it is like a jazz composition, in that a composition makes a statement. It says one thing. It says it nonverbally, of course. It makes a declaration or a promise or an affirmation, or it simply paints a picture. Mm-hmm. It's like abstract art in some ways. So you do that with a jazz composition, and that comes from the germ of an idea. And the idea needs to be, you need to play with it, you need to push against it, you need to stretch it, you need to twist it, you need to turn it upside down. Quite literally, sometime you play a melody, and then you play it backwards. This is all before anybody gets to hear it. And that might unlock different aspects of it. You do an analysis of how the melody is put together, or what harmony might support the melody, or what meter is this in? So it's all of that. It's creative gestation. And I guess what I did was, over the years, as I would speak here and there or preach here and there about jazz or at jazz services, I just acquired a whole bunch of topics And then I began to figure out how to sequence them and then research them more deeper. I will say, as a practitioner, that there's some things I'll preach in a pulpit that, can I dare say, are not thoroughly researched yet. Because Sundays keep coming around.
Yeah.
So you tell a story that you've heard or someone told you or you read somewhere and you kind of retell it, but it may not be precise and it may not even be accurate. So there was kind of a research phase to this as well, which for me meant reading about 60 musicians' biographies and a number of studies about jazz and a couple of rare and hard to find studies about jazz and some aspect of the spiritual life.
You had mentioned that my speaking of your two loves, they are one love, and it's important to look at the connecting word there. It's not jazz versus the spiritual life. It's jazz and the spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing.
That prompted immediate issues already. People will sometimes dismiss jazz as secular. And we had an early episode in this podcast when I was reflecting on the book early that there are a lot of people in my past who want to dismiss the music that I was playing in light of what I was going to do for my professional employment as a pastor. And it's a false dichotomy. I say it again and again in the book, there's a dotted line between sacred and secular, if there's a line at all.
Yeah. So as you think about the books that you read, the biographies of musicians, the stories that you've heard that you did not necessarily research, but heard them and used them in sermons and some of the conversations you had as you did your concerts, now you've got to organize this all. You've got to have a flow. It's like writing a novel. You may know where you start, but you better know where you're going for many authors. So tell me how you organize the material.
It's a brainstorming process, of course. But the primary tool are these little pads of paper with stickies on the back. And I would write down an idea or a theme on these little sticky pads. And I would put them all over the room and then on different walls. And then I would start to try rearrange them or group them or pull them together, knowing that everything I had written needed some elucidation, some elaboration, and some research. Mm-hmm. And then some of it, of course, brutally further along would have to be cut because there's simply too much information for too many people to process. But these little sticky notes literally were all over the wall. It's something I have done actually with extended jazz compositions. When I composed my Requiem Mass a couple of years ago during the pandemic, I was trying to figure out the sequence of the individual parts and what key they would each be in and the range of the singers and the sweet spots for the horn players, and then try to figure it out like a puzzle.
Yeah.
What piece fits here? What's the frame that goes around it, the sharp edge? Where am I trying to force something to fit that doesn't really fit?
Yeah. And I can see why that would be very similar to writing a composition in music. You make it an idea, a melody, but then you try to be a little bit creative and lose the flow of that.
Right.
So even that piece, that musical piece, has to be edited. And you don't always edit your own stuff either. If you're having something published in music, you got an editor for that too, don't you?
That's right. That's right. Although if you're self-published, you know, it's all on you unless you farm out some of that work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was fortunate to receive a grant from the Louisville Institute. That's a think tank based out of Louisville Presbyterian Seminary in Kentucky. They are stewards of some funds from the Lilly Endowment, and they try to sponsor grant proposals that they think are worthy, that would benefit the wider world. And I worked with them before with a couple of projects and with a couple of sabbatical projects. So I wrote up the grant for this, was fortunate to get the grant. It provided some time and space and funding, you know, first for the research, but also for the writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not something you can do on your couch at home. And it's not something you can do at your desk at work. You need a place to go to where your privacy can be protected.
You need a dedicated space for that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I had three for this project. One was a cottage that my friend Carl has near Whiteface Mountain in the Adirondacks of New York. Another is a cabin on the sea of Rhode Island, pretty close to Providence, mm-hmm. that our friend Nancy offered to us. And the third was a study office in the library at Marywood University, where I've been teaching jazz piano and jazz history for about 25 years. Mm-hmm. And a friend, my wife set this up, a friend said, "Hey, we have an office that's been vacated for the summer. Would you like to use it for your writing?" And it's off the beaten path. And it was a couple doors down from the restroom, which was the only break I needed. And there was a juice bar downstairs so I could get a break or, you know, some something for lunch.
Yep.
But I was able to knock down 95% of the book in a month and a half.
Wow, man.
And pretty disciplined about it. Now, I should say that the process was not in a straight line. I was supposed to do this in the summer of 2020. And in March of 2020, the pandemic hit.
Mm-hmm.
And it became very obvious as everything was shutting down, including the church I serve, that I could not abandon my people. So I deferred that project for a year. And that actually made the book better. There was more seasoning. I did have some opportunity for some research. Everybody was discovering Zoom. And and so I was doing interviews on Zoom with luminous jazz musicians and composers. And that was great. And then, of course, you can record the track, as we do when we do our podcasts, send it off to a transcriber electronically, and the next day you get back a Word file with everything that was said, and you just clean it up.
Wow. Yeah.
It was pretty, I wouldn't say it was easy or simple, but we generated a lot of material very quickly.
Yeah.
In addition to the things I've been thinking about for really 30 years.
In addition to the chapters of the book, you've added some poetry, which seems to me to have that musical touch of a lyric that doesn't interrupt, but connects the flow from chapter to chapter. Say something about the poetry.
Well, let me read one of them.
All right.
I called them improvisations, and really they were, in that they were all very spontaneous compositions, free verse poetry, not the rhyming kind. This was one called Refracted Light. There are 83 ways to see the furrowed brow, the risky decision, the red pomegranate. Let me harmonize the single note in 79 ways, adding incognito cluster or obscure sound. This gives it gristle. If Adam named 8 million animals in order to control them, he should have kept his mouth shut, especially around the tigers. Can we spin a story in 67 directions? Only if it is true. Insight flits through the open window. It lights upon a stale slice of bread and unveils the banquet. Here is the jazz assumption. There must be more.
Yeah, now that title reminds me of a piece of music we've been talking for some time now. Can we hear a little bit of music called
Sure.
Refracted Light?
Refracted Light. Well, actually, I wrote that poem originally at around the time I put that composition together. Most of that tune is based on a single note, an A. Mm. Or as Tony, the bass player, says, A. And we like to play with people with that. And but it just offers variations. It's major, it's minor, it's strange, it's stacked chords. So here's Refracted Light, and then we can talk about it a little bit.
Okay. So let's talk about the title of the book, Thriving on a Riff. This is not something apparently that you just dreamt about one night. This is a title of a jazz composition.
It is. It's a contrafact. You know what a contrafact is?
I used to.
Well, in the back of the book, there is a glossary of jazz terms. And a contrafact signifies a new melody built on an existing tune and its harmonic structure.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I figured it would be. And it's because in the copyright business, you can copyright melodies, but it's almost impossible to copyright a sequence of chords. So it'll be based on the structure. And the old tune, I've Got Rhythm, prompted 300 contrafacts, I'll bet. One of them titled Driving on a Riff. Melody written by Charlie Parker. Although some people think it might have been Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I love the title because it suggested and held together what I wanted to talk about, which was thriving, human thriving, a spiritual life, and a riff, which, according to the glossary, is a repeated phrase, kind of like the tune In the Mood, ba-ba-doo-ba-doo-ba-ba-dee-ba-doo-bop, there's your riff.
Yeah.
And then you change it a little bit as the harmony changes. And it adds some continuity, but it also is a building block for syncopation and swing.
Mm-hmm. So as you put the book together and think about this title, Thriving on a Riff, the thriving is certainly linked to one's spiritual life, where we want to be constantly growing, being nurtured not only by the spirit, but nurtured by the people who share their experiences of the spirit with us. And then the riff, tell me a little bit more about the riff of my life or yours.
Well, it's the rhythm. It's the melody.
Okay.
It's the harmony. Yeah. It's the texture. It's the marriage of all the others. It's the tune that you whistle when you're in the shower and it stays with you all day until it drives your spouse crazy. it's that recurring a musical piece, the soundtrack for your soul.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of this is rooted in an old quotation by the ancient Saint Irenaeus, who said one time, the glory of God is a human alive.
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of many rough translations, but he was talking about the incarnation, the coming together of in Jesus of divine and human, and completely melded, molded, shared, so that even in these days after Easter, Jesus appears to his disciples in a body, and the wounds from the crucifixion are still there.
Mm-hmm.
They've not been erased because he is human and he is divine.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the model for this. What does it mean for us to thrive? What does it mean for the realm of the spirit, however we perceive that, to fill us, to enlarge us, to heal us, to awaken us to the things we've not been paying attention to, and also to provide a bit of a soundtrack?
And some of the ideas that relate to the title of the book come from very real stories of jazz musicians whose names most readers are going to know. I am assuming that folks who pick up the book, first of all, have some knowledge of jazz to begin with. And so they'll know the stories of, Billie Holiday, for example. Right. Some of these stories were not particularly happy stories in spite of the success that someone may have had in jazz performance.
Well, that's right. Or the story of Jimmy Green, great saxophonist who lives in Connecticut and was the music director for Harry Connick Jr.'s band for a while. His little baby daughter was murdered in gun violence at the Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Hmm.
In fact, just a short period ago, he marked her what would have been her 18th birthday.
Oh, my.
I mean, the pain is still there and the loss is still there. But I want to tell the story not only of that, but how he got through it and how the musicians came around him to support him and how he found some consolation in the making of music.
Mm-hmm. And the fellowship of the musicians, the community that gathers. We talk in the church about a community of faith.
Right.
It's too unlike the community of the jazz heart that comes together.
Well, it is. It's called the hang, which is short for hanging out.
Yeah.
And you were with me one night. I think we were at a little steak place to go hear a band, and they showed up late, and it went on and on and on. And we were there 3 or 4 hours. I finally got in the car with my wife to drive an hour home. And I said, welcome to the hang.
Right.
She said, "Is this is what it's like?" I said, "Yeah, this is pretty much what it's like."
Yeah.
It's life off the bandstand.
Yeah. There's also that wonderful story of, remind me of the trumpet player. He was in the Tonight Show band and was near death and went in Marcel.
Oh, Clark Terry.
Yeah, the story about Clark Terry, there was a hang that was ministry among musicians.
That's right. Wynton Marsalis and the Lincoln Center Jazz Band, big band, was traveling, and they had a free day in their schedule, and someone realized, Wynton perhaps, that Clark Terry was in a hospital bed near the end of his life, blind from diabetes, really, really frail, not able to hear much, and they went like hundreds of miles out of their way to go visit him and perform Happy Birthday to him. You know, that's a common story, not just for those people and those musicians, but any musicians who really care about one another. There's a lot that happens kind of after hours or before hours or around the edges that no one ever sees. When we would do some traveling, when Al Hamm was still alive and he had a big old Toyota van, we'd get in the van and I'd navigate and he'd be up front, always driving. And then Tony, the bass player, and Ron, the drummer, would be in the back seat watching. We were watching videos. We had a Mel Brooks film festival, watching films that could not be made these days. And in the off moments, they were comparing marinara recipes. Yeah. At what point do you put the basil in? Do you dry it? Do you leave it fresh? It's like, this is the hang. It's the community. In church, we call it fellowship. But anybody outside the church doesn't know what a ship word is, a fellowship word.
Yeah. We have fellowship halls. We could have hang halls.
Hang halls.
They may not work. So when you look back at this whole process, I mean, obviously you must be very excited that the book is in print and will be available within days, can be ordered preferably through independent booksellers.
That's right. Our preferred bookseller is a small store in Dallastown, Pennsylvania, near York, called Hearts and Minds, heartsandmindsbooks.com. In fact, as of this podcast, the proprietor, Byron Borger, is offering a 20% discount to anybody who wants to purchase it. And we'll put that in the show notes, heartsandmindsbooks.com.
So with a book out, most people go on tour and do autograph sessions, and I would imagine a musician would go and play a little bit. So what's next? What are you going to do to promote this?
Well, we've been scheduling some concerts here and there throughout the year, 2024, getting around, and books will always be with us along with the CDs. We have a couple of opportunities to go to bookstores and do some promotion. We're still putting some of that together.
Well, so that's Bill and I have been talking about the Thriving on a Riff, Jazz and the Spiritual Life from Broadleaf Books, which is a major religious publisher. This is not self-published.
1517 Media, which is the Evangelical Lutheran Publishing House.
Yeah.
Fortress Press and presses like that are under the same umbrella.
Right.
Jeff, as we're winding up, we didn't have a chance to play the rest of that tune, Refracted Light. So let's play the rest of that so people can hear the whole composition from the middle to the end.
Thank you. And that's Refracted Light, the conclusion of that piece of music from the Interior Window CD by the Presby Bopp Quartet. And that is the conclusion of this edition of the Spirit of Jazz podcast.
Tune in again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is a production of Presby Bopp Music. To find out more about Presby Bopp, our music, concerts, and recordings, please explore our website at www.presbybopp.com. And send us a note telling us what you think about the Spirit of Jazz. We'd love to hear from you. Check in with us again next time. I'm Jeff Kellum.
And I'm Bill Carter. Thanks for tuning in.